This episode of Dummy is sponsored by Audible. You can get a free audiobook download and a free 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/holler. There are more than 150,000 titles to choose from, and you can play them from your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. To get your free audiobook and support this podcast, just visit audibletrial.com/holler.
Hello and welcome to Dummy, a twice weekly conversation among editors and friends of Howler magazine. My name is George Qureshi. I am the editor of Howler. My usual podmates, David Goldblatt, Danny Carbassian, will be joining us tomorrow so that we can react to the U.S. game against Belgium. That'll be out in the morning. Today, we have a preview of sorts. We have an update from the U.S. camp from Alex Abnos. We have conversations with two more people about the game. The first is with Bobby Warshaw, who played for the U.S. as a youth international and now plays for Geis in the Swedish league. He recently wrote a piece for the website I'm editing this summer, soccer.fusion.net, defending Michael Bradley from some of the criticism he's received from his performances in the group stage, and we will speak about Bradley and some of the other tactical questions we're eager to see answered in the match later today. And because we love a good historical take on this show, I will speak with George Brown, who earned a cap for the U.S. men's national team back in 1957. But in this case, I'm actually more curious about his father, Jim Brown, who played for the U.S. in the 1930 World Cup, including our 3-0 win over Belgium that year, and went on to play for Manchester United, Spurs, and a couple other teams you've definitely heard of. So I'll talk to both of those guys, and hopefully you'll be able to spend the rest of the day with visions of bald eagles soaring through your heads, fully pumped and ready to face Belgium. Okay, let's get started. Hey, Bobby Warshaw, you are a soccer player. You play for Geis in Gothenburg, and you are a defender, right?
Actually, right now a forward, but a little bit everything. I've played everywhere so far this year.
Okay, all right, excellent. So you are really well-positioned, pardon the pun, to tell us why Michael Bradley might be struggling with the U.S. national team. You wrote a piece for soccer.fusion.net the other day I'll let you tell people. Has to do with his positioning.
Yeah, I think Michael Bradley hasn't been all that sharp and has been getting a little slack for it, you know, both in conversation and on Twitter. And I just don't think we fully appreciate or understand kind of what he's going through or what he's doing right now. Because he's been very, very good at a certain position, and right now he's not exactly playing that position. So he's doing something a little different.
I'll tell you what I've noticed. I went to the Jacksonville game, the Nigeria-U.S. game, and I think this was the first time that Klinsmann had done this, but, Michael Bradley was playing right behind Josie Altidore. Clint Dempsey was actually pushed out to the left because that's usually where Clint plays. And that allowed Kyle Beckerman basically to come into the deep midfield, and play alongside Jermaine Jones. Now, Jermaine Jones has had a really good tournament so far, and I think a lot of people are giving him the credit he's due. He and Michael Bradley are not getting in each other's way as they have for a lot of the last couple of years. We've seen that happening a lot. And so you make the point that Michael Bradley is playing higher up the field. It gives Jermaine Jones more room to play, but it also leads to Michael sort of being in an uncomfortable position.
Yeah. I actually think that one of the beautiful things about having Beckerman on the field is that he's a passer. He's a pass and move guy, which fits with Michael. And Jermaine isn't necessarily a pass and move kind of guy. He works really hard. He wins loose balls, but he's not the kind of guy that gets it and gives it and, you know, will get it back. So Beckerman and Bradley have this really good relationship. But when you have Jermaine out there, he's kind of a different style. I'm not going to say he messes things up, but he's just kind of on his own a little more than those two. So yeah, Jermaine's having I think we've seen a lot of times before is that Michael plays really well and Jermaine hasn't been that great. He's been a little reckless. And right now, for whatever reason, it's flipped and Jermaine has been fantastic and Michael has been a little off.
Yeah. I mean, One of the things that when I think of like a quintessential Michael Bradley play, it's like him picking up the ball deep in the U.S. midfield and making a run. Like I'm thinking about that goal we scored against Panama in qualifying last year in Seattle, where it went out. Michael Bradley got it, went out wide to Fabian Johnson on the left. He played the cross in, and Josie scored. And it was this great counterattacking move. And it started when Michael Bradley, I think he got a pass from Jeff Cameron, but he basically brought the ball up maybe 30, 40 yards. And those are the kinds of runs he can't make now because he's starting so high up the field and playing with his back to goal a lot more. And just sort of, you know, that's a position where defenders squeeze a little. They're more cognizant of what's going on. They don't give you as much time on the ball. And so he's not playing in that place where he's comfortable, where he's sort of in a zone, as you put it in the piece.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, at this level, really at any level, it's all about confidence, right? It's all about how you feel and how much conviction you have on the ball. And when you're playing in your natural position, you always know what to do, and you can kind of do little things, little passes that you've done a million times and build that confidence. And when you're higher up the field in a different position, you know, that doesn't come as naturally. And you can't do those little actions to make you feel good and get rolling. So yeah, when he's doing things like playing higher up and with his back to goal, he's just not quite comfortable, and one mess up kind of gets your whole flow off.
You know, one thing that, you know, I was going to say that he's really not the kind of player we want playing right behind the striker, but you know, he had a great that layoff to Fabian Johnson against Turkey was really nice, and that was the kind of ball that someone in his position, his new position, should be playing, and he did that really well. It was perfect. Is there a player on the team that you think maybe would be better suited to that position? Like, how would you change things? Would you change things, first of all? And if you would, like, what do you think a different setup might look like?
Yeah, that's a great question, because the ultimate thing, we're getting pretty good at developing players and teams, but to date, we really haven't developed a great number 10. You know, at times we try to play Reyna or John O'Brien or Landon there, but it's really like the one thing America has never developed is a guy for Justin behind those forwards. But also, you have to remember what
Even
kind of
Tab
style that
Ramos,
Americans.
yeah, even Tab Ramos was sort of, you know, I think of him out on the wing a little more and not really operating, you know, in centrally quite as much.
Exactly. So looking, you know, the history of U.S. soccer, that's always been our one Achilles heel. I mean, maybe we've got more than one, but that's kind of the one thing that you can really point at. And so we've never truly developed that kind of player. But you also remember the kind of style that the Americans play in the World Cup too, is that, you know, we watch these games, we want them to keep possession and, I don't know, tiki taka and play. And but at the end of the day, you know, all but five teams in the World Cup compete, stay organized, and fight. So as nice as it would be to have a Jose Torres or maybe a mix or another forward up there, at the end of the day, we have to have guys that can put in the work and tackle and stay organized. And Michael's as good as anyone in the world at that. You know, so to a certain degree, like, we want him to be able to play and create and pass, but God, we got to give Michael a lot of credit for the work he's putting in, the defensive discipline, the organization, the leadership. So part of it's, yeah, it'd be nice to have like a number 10 and behind the forwards, but Michael's got a lot of the qualities that Klinsmann and as American fans, we want to see in that kind of guy.
Okay, Bobby, I really enjoyed speaking with you. Thanks for coming on to Dummy.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
Up next, we have George Brown. He actually played for the U.S. national team himself, but he's here to talk about his dad, who was on the field when the U.S. beat Belgium on the way to a semifinal run at the very first World Cup back in 1930. So thank you so much for joining me on Dummy. First of all, I really want to welcome you to the podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure, George.
Okay, so I'm speaking with George Brown. George, you are up in Oneonta, New York. You were born in England because your father was a professional soccer player there, but he was an American. Your dad represented the United States in the 1930 World Cup 5 years before you were born. Can you tell me what do you know about that? I'm really curious about this.
Actually, I know a fair amount about the, in particular, the first game against Belgium. Well, let me back up a little. My dad was only about 20, and he had come out to the States, and by virtue of his father being here, he was legally entitled to play for the U.S. When they went down to Uruguay, they were on the boat for about a month, and when they arrived in Uruguay, they were called the muscle man, because they had trained so hard and they were so fit. And their opening game was actually on July the 13th, 1930. They met Belgium, which is kind of neat because they meet them tomorrow. The interesting thing was that they beat Belgium in that first World Cup by a score of 3-0, and they had the referee was Argentinian. And interestingly enough, the U.S. team, when it entered the field, it was carrying the Uruguayan flag, followed by the Stars and Stripes.
Really?
Yes, and they entered and they sang the Stein song. I remember my father telling me that when they had their berets on and their U.S. Uniforms, and they were very well received by the local crowd.
That's amazing. So your father, his name is Jim Brown. He was born in Scotland. Played for the United States because he came over. He was pretty young when he came over, right?
Oh yes, he was only about 20.
And so when he came over and he started playing in New York, he was playing for Newark. I'm looking at the Wikipedia page: Newark Skeeters, the New York Nationals, the New York Giants soccer team, and then Brooklyn Wanderers in 1931, which is after the World Cup. Newark Americans, and then he moves over to Manchester United. He played 40 games, scored 17 goals for United. Brentford, Tottenham Hotspur, Guildford City, Clyde, and yet only four caps for the U.S. And those, I assume, all came during the 1930 World Cup.
That's correct. He simply wasn't over in this country very long.
That's amazing. Did he ever play for England or for Scotland?
No, he never did. In fact, his career was not all that stellar over when he returned to play for the first time in professional soccer. He had never played professional soccer before he went to the States. He was a union man, and union men were not accepted in those days. So while he scored a bundle of goals with Man U, he scored a bundle of goals with Tottenham Hotspurs. He didn't last very long because they got rid of union men immediately. So he had the life of a working journeyman soccer player.
And this is well before soccer players were paid anything like what they are now. They were paid very, very poorly back then.
He made £7 per game. It was actually £5 with a £2 bonus for a win. He made £7. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 pounds. It was a class system over in the UK in those days.
That is amazing. And now you also played. You have, I believe, one cap for the United States back in the 1950s.
That's correct. I had nowhere near the career that my father had, but I was honored to play for the U.S. against Mexico. Of course, we got hammered. I think the score was 6-0. But that wasn't unusual in those days. It's a far cry from the professional approach that they're taking now with the U.S. team.
So take me back to the 1930 World Cup. I know that we went and played Belgium in the first game. We beat them 3-0, as you said. That was a really amazing World Cup for the U.S. We made it to the semifinals that year.
That's correct. Well, I believe there were only 13 teams in it, George.
Hey, come on. You're killing my mojo here. We had a great team. Come on, we made it to the semifinals of the World Cup.
You're absolutely right. It was an outstanding team. They actually had a very solid team, and in fact, Bert Patenoid, who was the center forward as they called it in those days, he scored the first hat trick in World Cup history.
Right. He was only 20 years old as well. We had these amazing young guys playing for us.
Yes, and the majority of them learned the game in the States. There was a myth that they were from Scotland and England. But in fact, Colin Jost, who was the historian for the Soccer Hall of Fame, he did extensive research. And there was only one player that had actually played first division soccer over in the UK before playing on the 1930 World Cup team.
Wow. So I'm looking at the Wikipedia page again for the squad for that year. They list the number of caps, and I assume this is the number of caps that each player had when they came to the World Cup. We have midfielder Andy Auld, one cap. Mike Bookie, zero. Jim Brown, three caps. He was your father was the second most experienced national team player at that World Cup, and he had three caps. Jimmy Douglas, the goalkeeper, had five. He was the most experienced.
That's correct. But most of those caps were earned during the World Cup.
Amazing. Let me ask you one more thing here. Sure. Billy Gonzalez is a name that I've heard a lot about. Do you remember your father ever speaking about him?
Yes.
What do you know about him?
Billy Gonzalez was, my father said he could hit a ball with his left foot or his right foot equally well. He was built like a tank. Nothing could stop him. He was very much like Lloyd Munson, who starred for the U.S. Back in the 50s and 60s. He was very powerful. He was lethal on the turn, and he could hit the shots on the full volley. There were two or three like that. Bart McGee was an extraordinary player, and in fact, they speak in that Belgium game, that very first game. They talk, and I'll quote you something because it's kind of insightful. It says, just passing the first half hour, a lightning shot from the right wing found the crossbar only to bounce out to the left and not far from the touch and close to the halfway line. Bart McGee on the left wing let go with a first timer that beat the Belgium goalie all the way. And the lightning shot from the right wing was from my father, and he said it was a mishit pass.
That sounds like an American soccer player right there.
But it went out to McGee, who was well out, and he just hammered it home.
That is amazing. George Brown, thank you so much. I want to get your prediction for tomorrow before I let you go.
U.S. will take it 2-1.
Excellent. I hope you're right. George Brown, thank you so much for joining us on Dummy. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thanks, George.
Now we're going to hear from Alexander Abnos, who is an editor with Howler Magazine. He's also, separately from that, reporting for USsoccer.com this summer from Brazil. This is Alex.
Hey, how's it going, everyone? Alex Abnos coming to you here from the Arena Fontenova in Salvador, Brazil. Just got done with the day with the U.S. national team, and it was a pretty big day for them on a lot of different fronts. They had their last training today before facing Belgium in the round of 16 tomorrow, and they also got some really, really good news. Striker Josie Altidore will be available for selection after his hamstring injury. What exactly that means, I guess we'll have to wait and find out. Jurgen Klinsmann stayed really tight-lipped on how much Altidore can actually play. So we don't know if he'll be able to bring him on as a sub or even if he'll be starting. That'll just be a mystery that we'll have to see how it unfolds against Belgium tomorrow. As for the game itself, I mean, this is going to be a big challenge for the U.S. Klinsmann said so in his press conference. Belgium, of course, incredibly talented. But Clint Dempsey also said that over the course of the three games in the group stage, the U.S. learned a lot about itself and gained a lot of confidence in the way they play. They did go through a lot of experiences in that first round, and I think that might end up helping them against Belgium. They've, you know, won really late on against Ghana, and they also, you know, surrendered a late goal themselves against Portugal. So they kind of know what they need to work on going into this game and the kind of mentality that they need, and that can only mean really, really good things. As for Salvador itself, that could end up being a factor in this game. Both Klinsmann and the Belgium coach, Mark Wilmots, were asked about the hot conditions here. It's probably the hottest city the U.S. has visited so far. Other cities might have been a little bit more humid or a lot more humid, but few have had this kind of straight-on just heat that Salvador has had. So it's a little bit different, but, you know, Klinsmann basically repeated the line that has been the U.S.'s line all along, which is that these players, you know, deal with this kind of stuff all the time in MLS. And I think that's a decent viewpoint. Wilmots, the Belgium coach, had a slightly different view. I mean, he said that no doubt the heat will affect the game, but it affects both teams. So that might end up being a factor. It might not, but it's something to keep an eye on. And it's definitely something that the U.S. hasn't faced quite in this way yet in the tournament. That's all from me for now. This is Alex Abnos signing off from Brazil.
That does it for this episode of Dummy. I want to thank Bobby Warshaw for joining us today. I also want to thank three generations of the Brown family. James Brown for beating Belgium, George Brown for telling us all about it, and George's son James, who put us in touch with his father in the first place. Howler editor Alexander Abnos is reporting from Salvador, where he is covering the World Cup for USsoccer.com. The Howler singers are led by Lindsay Elliott. They're members of the choral ensemble Ghostlight, and they made our theme tune. All the rest of the music is by Brian Kim. Tune in again tomorrow when we'll have David and Danny back for a full recap of the game and all of the Round of 16 games up till now. We'll also have a great discussion with a professor from the University of Florida about the promises Brazil made on the environmental front. You will not be surprised to learn that the Brazilian government is failing to keep those promises, but two researchers are using the tournament's mascot, an endangered armadillo, or I don't know, like a cousin of the armadillo, to do something about it. This podcast was produced by Matthew Nelson, with help from Ryan Katniss, Kira Deppenbrock, and Malena Barajas. My name is George Qureshi. Until next time, thank you for listening.
For you, the listeners of Dummy, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial. You'll be supporting this podcast and getting a free audiobook. And all you have to do is sign up at audibletrial.com/holler. That's audibletrial.com/holler.